Hello, this is Sandra Ferguson with the Friday, June 14th, 2019 edition of the News Gazette. And we'll begin on the front page with a piece about the Brent Christensen trial, Day 9, called FBI Details Efforts to Find Murder Victim. Defense calls for a mistrial over part of video shown. Judge rejects idea. By Ben Zigerman, Peoria. In the weeks after Yingning Zhang went missing, FBI agents and University of Illinois police officers searched through garbage at Centennial Park, an isolated area near Olympian Road and Interstate 57, and at the Murdoch Mine, 30 miles south of Champaign. They went there based on tips and pings from Christensen's phone, but repeatedly came up empty. We were doing everything we could to try to determine where Yingying was, FBI agent Joel Smith testified Thursday, the second day of the prosecution's case against Brent Christensen. Smith described an exhausting and exhaustive search, with the FBI brought on to assist UI police and eventually calling on its Springfield office for backup. At Centennial Park, the garbage cans go 6 feet deep into the ground, so the FBI had the Champaign Park District use its equipment to lift them out, and Smith said he cut each of the 14 liners open with a knife, but found nothing. Near I-57, they searched for 2 hours, but found nothing, Smith said. They interviewed multiple sexual partners of Christensen, Smith said, but learned nothing useful to finding Ms. Zhang. The FBI was called in 3 days after Ms. Zhang went missing, June 9, 2017. UI police had identified her getting into a black Saturn Astra, but agents were getting exhausted. They were working with minimal rest, FBI agent Anthony Manganaro testified Wednesday. In the first 3 weeks of the search, they were working 20-hour days, Smith said. Manganaro was called into the case by his supervisor, who was on his first day on the job and made Manganaro the point person on this case. Manganaro said there was a level of desperation among UI police, especially since they didn't know where the car in the video went. When Smith went to Christensen's apartment looking for local Astra owners, Christensen said he might have been sleeping or playing video games, Smith said. He mostly appeared normal, Smith said, but his fingers were shaking when he checked his phone for text messages from June 9th, and when Smith's partner searched the Astra's glove box, Christensen broke eye contact with Smith for a few seconds. 2 days later, a UI police officer noticed a crack in the right front hubcap of the Astra and a sunroof, which matched Christensen's Astra. That night, they tracked down U.S. Magistrate Judge Eric Long at a park, who was there for his daughter's event, and he signed a search warrant for Christensen's car. They lined up a tow truck and executed the search warrant that night, interviewing Christensen at an FBI field office less than a mile away from his apartment. At Wednesday's hearing, prosecutors played the nearly hour-long interview with UI police officer Eric Stiverson, Manganaro, and Christensen. During the interview, Christensen tried to stick to his initial story of playing video games and napping. "We know that's not true," Stiverson said. "Why would I lie?" Christensen responded. Stiverson explained that there was extensive video surveillance around campus. "I've seen the videos, but I didn't see me," Christensen said. Stiverson said he saw his arms fully extended and asked, "Where'd you drop her off?" At this point, Christensen started to sound nervous and replied, "Maybe I'm getting my days mixed up then. I thought I drove around Saturday. I did pick a girl up who spoke broken English in the early afternoon." He said he let her out a couple blocks away after he apparently made a wrong turn. Then he said he went home. "That was enough for me that day," Christensen said. He was driving around, just trying to clear my head, more or less, because his wife was away that weekend with her new boyfriend in Wisconsin. Manganaro said he didn't think he let her out and asked Christensen if he was trying to hook up with the girl he picked up. That would have been nice, Christensen said. But he insisted he didn't have sex with her and that he let her out a few blocks away. Stiverson let him know they can track phones. I know you didn't drop her off in that neighborhood, he said. Where'd you take her? Manganaro demanded. We need to find Yingying. I think it's time that I stopped answering questions, Christensen said, ending the interview. At this point in the trial Thursday, the court took a lunch break, and when the proceedings resumed, Assistant Federal Defender George Tassif called for a mistrial because the prosecution had played portions of the video showing Christensen invoking his rights. This is terribly prejudicial to this man, he said. U.S. District Judge Jim Shadid asked why this concern wasn't raised earlier and how it was relevant given the defense's opening statement in which they admitted Christensen killed Ms. Zhang. He asked whether it would affect whether the jury would find Christensen guilty. It very well could, Tassif said, noting that they have a duty to raise issues as they see them arise. Shadid denied the motion, and Manganaro's testimony continued. Manganaro explained the various Google searches Christensen had made from the day before Ms. Zhang went missing to the day he was arrested 3 weeks later. On June 8th, he searched for OxyClean and laundry. 3 days after he abducted Ms. Zhang, he searched how iPhone tracking works. 5 days later, he visited the UI police website on the search for Ms. Zhang, which he would repeatedly visit over the coming days, and a News Gazette article on the FBI's $10,000 reward for information leading to Ms. Zhang's location. In the following days, he visited the Wikipedia page about the search, the family's GoFundMe fundraising page, and international news articles on the search. On June 20th, he searched obstruction of justice and obstruction of justice Illinois penalty. On June 27th, he visited the News Gazette's article on an upcoming campus vigil for Ms. Zhang multiple times, and then multiple articles about the FBI announcing they'd located the Astra. On the day of the vigil, 2 days later, he visited the News Gazette article about it 4 times. The following day, he checked the UI police's search page at 10:19 a.m. and again at 12:05 p.m. He was arrested later that day, his 28th birthday. During cross-examination, Assistant Federal Defender Elizabeth Pollack questioned the prosecutor's timeline of events the morning of Ms. Zhang's kidnapping. After he went to Schnucks and quickly bought a bottle of Admiral Nelson's spiced rum for $17.99 at 7:51 a.m., his car was seen on campus surveillance footage beginning at 8:22 a.m. In that time, the prosecution said in its opening statement, he went home and shaved. Asked whether Christensen would have been able to both shave and cross town during rush hour in 30 minutes, Manganaro admitted it might have been tight. Pollack also questioned the relevance of Manganaro's testimony about Christensen buying a 6-foot green duffel bag 6 days before Ms. Zhang was abducted. The FBI bought one of its own, and Manganaro held it up for the jurors to see. It appeared to be taller than him, and certainly taller than Ms. Zhang, who was 5'4". But Pollack said that Christensen's wife had seen that bag in their apartment 3 days after he killed Ms. Zhang. She saw him carry the bag out without difficulty and didn't notice anything out of the ordinary, Pollack said. No smells or stains. Pollack also questioned Manganiello about the FBI's search for Christensen's 13 alleged victims, which he is heard saying on a wire recording his girlfriend made, trying to establish that Christensen's statements into the wire can't be trusted. Manganiello confirmed that they checked his criminal history and found nothing, and checked his DNA with the database and found nothing. Pollack also said they checked his financial history, texts, and social media history, but couldn't find anything. Manganiello said it was a difficult search because they didn't have any names of the purported victims. In response, Assistant U.S. Attorney Brian Frères asked if the FBI knew where Christensen had been every minute of his life. "They did not," Manganiello said. And Frères asked if the FBI always found everyone on their missing persons list. "They did not," Manganiello said. That finished up questioning Thursday, the second day of Christensen's trial, where he faces the death penalty if convicted. The prosecution will continue calling witnesses today and is expected to play the incriminating wire recordings Christensen's girlfriend made of Christensen at the campus vigil. And next, from the Urbana Police Department, interim chief picked to fill job full-time. Bryant Serafin is a 25-year department veteran UI alumnus. By Mary Schenck, Urbana. Urbana police officers will have no trouble transitioning to their new police chief. Mayor Diane Marlin announced Thursday that Bryant Serafin, a 25-year veteran of the department, has been named to the post. He succeeds Sylvia Morgan, who retired 10 months ago. Serafin has been serving as interim chief since then. The city council will be asked to approve Serafin's appointment Monday. Marlin praised Serafin, who's been with the department since October 1994. "For the past 9 months, while he has served as interim chief, I have observed him in many different public and private settings," she said. "In each, he has demonstrated a respectful, knowledgeable, and open-minded approach, a willingness to listen, and a commitment to uphold the high professional standards of the Urbana Police Department." As interim chief, Mr. Serafin implemented the use of body-worn cameras in the police department, worked closely with Urbana District 116 to address school safety issues, and expanded community outreach efforts, she said. Serafin is a 1994 graduate of the University of Illinois, where he received a bachelor's degree in sociology with a specialization in criminology. He has served as a patrol officer, a field training officer, a member of the Metro SWAT team, and as a detective. In 2007, he was promoted to lieutenant, supervising criminal investigations, a role he held until 2015 when he was transferred back to a supervisory position over patrol. He was named deputy chief in 2017. Married with two sons, Serafin is an executive committee member of the Champaign County Community Coalition and a Boy Scout troop leader. "I am honored to have the mayor's trust and support as I move forward into this role," he said, "and I look forward to working with her, city leadership, the citizens, and our police officers to foster a collaborative working relationship within this community." "Nobody should be scared," the affable Serafin said of his promotion, which he learned of Monday from Marlin. Serafin said the details of his salary have not been fully worked out. He's currently earning about $140,000 annually as interim chief. Another familiar face will be Serafin's right-hand man. Marlin announced that interim deputy chief Robert Fitzgerald has been named to the deputy chief position. Prior to joining the department in 1998, Fitzgerald was a patrol officer, tactical officer, and gang tactical officer with the Chicago Police Department. He was named Urbana Police Department Officer of the Year in 2005. He was promoted to sergeant in 2006 and lieutenant in 2010, initially overseeing patrol in the South District of the city, and most recently, the department's services division. Although he has not selected an exact date, Fitzgerald plans to retire before the end of the year. The department currently has 57 sworn officers and 14 civilian employees. And next, a piece from court sentencing. Probation violator getting a second shot, some jail time, by Mary Shank, Urbana. A 19-year-old Urbana man who failed to live up to the terms of his probation has been sentenced to more probation. But Judge Tom DeFantis on Thursday also sentenced Kevon Barber, 19, of the 300 block of Scottswood Drive, to 120 days in jail to get Barber's attention and deter others from committing the same crimes he did, burglary to a motor vehicle and leaving the scene of an accident. Barber pleaded guilty in February to aiding another man who entered a woman's car at a Champagne liquor store on May 24, 2018, while she was inside the store. Both Barber and his co-defendant were sentenced to probation. At the same time, Barber pleaded guilty to a second offense of leaving the scene of an injury accident on January 17th. Assistant State's Attorney Troy Lozar said he hit several cars and then fled. The state took stops to revoke Barber's probation when he failed to show up for appointments with his probation officer, gave her a false address and phone number, tested positive for using cannabis, and didn't finish his high school diploma. Barber admitted in late April that he violated his probation in both cases, but has since finished his GED and stayed out of trouble. Lozar recommended a 3-year prison term for both convictions, while Assistant Public Defender Matt Hamm sought an additional period of probation, saying that Barber has been reporting regularly recently. DeFantis agreed that Barber was showing promise and resentenced him to 18 months of probation, but also gave him 4 months in the county jail, with credit for 1 month already served. In addition to the convictions for which he was being resentenced, Barber has one for domestic battery. And we'll turn now to the opinions page, and we'll begin with an editorial called NCAA Waiting to Pounce. After the trials comes the deluge. The federal criminal investigation of illegal recruiting in college basketball didn't turn out to be the blockbuster that federal prosecutors suggested it would be. But the revelations produced by trials involving shoe company executives, assistant college basketball coaches, and player agents still provided the NCAA plenty to chew on. That's why a top NCAA executive recently disclosed that at least 6 major college basketball programs will be receiving dreaded letters of inquiry by the end of summer. Stan Wilcox, the organization's vice president for regulatory affairs, was surprisingly specific about what the future holds vis-a-vis the NCAA investigation stemming from the federal criminal probe. He said 2 high-profile programs will receive inquiry notices by mid-July and another 4 will get them by the end of summer. Plus, he said, there's even another group of cases we're still working on. Skeptics have been underwhelmed for years by the NCAA's investigative prowess, but Wilcox promised that we're moving forward and you'll see consequences. After Wilcox's comments, speculation turned immediately to the possible targets, not just the schools, but the head coaches, who can be held responsible for wrongdoing committed by subordinates. They include the creme de la creme of college basketball, Kansas, Louisville, Arizona, as well as lesser but still formidable programs like Auburn, Oklahoma State, the University of Southern California, Florida, and Louisiana State. Each was mentioned prominently in the trial related to the illegal recruiting of top high school basketball talent by top programs affiliated with prominent shoe companies. The NCAA's advantage in pursuing these alleged violations is that it doesn't have to rely on its own investigators to do the work. In this case, the NCAA can use the information introduced at the public trials of a handful of defendants and the guilty pleas entered by numerous assistant basketball coaches. The federal investigation, for the most part, did not reveal the kind of unsavory behavior that shocked jaded fans. Everyone paying attention knows there's a dark underbelly to college recruiting that goes back, in one form or another, decades. What is surprising is how deeply ingrained the corrupt tactics are and the extent to which prominent and otherwise respectable businesses are in the process. Given the market value, whether above ground or underground, of certain high-profile young athletes, it would be the height of naivety to think athletes would not want to cash in. That's why the NCAA is going to have to come up with rules that allow players to share in the vast wealth college sports generate. Until that happens, however, basketball schools and coaches will have to make choices about how they'll go about recruiting. As for those programs that already have chosen the direction they would take, the NCAA is threatening to bring the hammer down in a way that has the potential, for at least a while, to shape up the power structure in a big way. And we'll turn now to the From Our Readers section, and we will begin with a piece written by Ben Leroy of Champaign called Example Unfairly Singled Out Group. The News Gazette editorial criticizing the recently passed capital improvements bill calls out the legislature for funding $370,000 of building renovations for a Muslim organization. The editorial board rightly disapproves of public money going to private religious purpose. Fair enough. But is anyone surprised that this editorial board chose to criticize an appropriation for a Muslim organization despite substantially greater appropriations flowing to Christian and Jewish institutions around the state? HB 0062, the bill containing the Muslim organization appropriation, the News Gazette highlights, also disburses at least $1.4 million for at least six churches and $140,000 for a Catholic university. It further contains $250,000 for two synagogues and $300,000 for the Hebrew Theological College. Somehow, all of these escaped the editorial board's notice. What a coincidence! Of course, the News Gazette's anti-Muslim dog whistling is old news and should surprise nobody. This is, after all, a media company that regularly broadcasts anti-Muslim tantrums from its two biggest syndicated revenue generators, Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity. Penny for your thoughts, callers expressing anti-Muslim sentiment rarely get any pushback from the show's host. On both the print and broadcast sides, the company's editorial leaders rarely miss an opportunity to put down the Muslim religious minority. The hard-working folks on the news side of News Gazette Media's platforms are much more responsible, ethical, and professional than their editorial brethren when their stories touch on religion and diversity. I hope that the editorial side someday learns from the news side's example. But I'm not holding my breath. And that again was written by Ben Leroy of Champaign. The next piece is written by Hugh Gallivan of Champaign called Higher Tax Will End Up Helping Us. Did you know your taxes are going down thanks to our legislators in Springfield? No? For many years now, you've been paying a hidden decay tax. Our state gas tax has been at the same level for nearly 30 years. What do you buy today that costs the same as it did in 1991? Not much. So, as construction costs go up, and as more people drive vehicles that can go farther on one tank of gas, we pay more for every damaged tire that strikes a pothole, and for every hour we wait stuck in traffic, or wait on that train to pick us up or drop us off. We don't realize it, but it becomes a painful tax that just keeps climbing. I am grateful for the support of Representatives Tom Bennett, Mike Maron, and Senators Chapin Rose and Jason Barrickman, who voted to end the decay tax. While that means we will pay more up front when we fill up, we will be driving on safer, smoother pavement and taking trains that are on time and more reliable. People will be working good-paying jobs on construction sites, spending more dollars on our local businesses. The next time you fill up, that extra $17 a month that the average driver will be paying is actually a savings of much more. Thank you, legislators and Governor Pritzker, for stepping up to end the hidden taxes and fix our important transportation system to get us all where we need to go. And that again was written by Hugh Gallivan of Champaign. The next piece is written by Steve Carton of Champaign, called Trump Doesn't Support Democracy. The main reason I will not vote for President Trump in 2020 is because, by his actions and words, he has consistently demonstrated disrespect and contempt for the following: the U.S. Congress, our judicial system, including but not limited to the U.S. Supreme Court, our intelligence community, and our traditional allies abroad, and a free press. The main reason I will not vote for Trump is because he does not believe in democracy. And that again was written by Steve Carton of Champaign. The next piece is written by George Brock of Champaign, called One Way to Truly Make Things Right. After reading the latest missive regarding formal retirement of Chief Illiniwek, I have a hard time believing that issue is any closer to being solved. All I am reading is that we did such a good job with our latest effort to staunch the ongoing dispute. We live in the state of Illinois, a geographical location named after a tribe of First Nation peoples. We stole their land, and the ongoing mortality statistics for the survivors are nothing to write home about. Until we welcome student survivors of this culture with the same zeal that we honor athletics scholars or rocket scientists, this is dead on arrival. And that again was written by George Brock of Champaign. And the last from our reader's piece that we'll read today is written by Karen Clousing of Charleston, called The Truth About U.S. Healthcare. Many people insist the U.S. has the best healthcare in the world. If that's true, then how can it be that pregnancy-related deaths actually went up between 1990 and 2015 in the U.S., while they were reduced by almost half in the rest of the world? Dr. Neil Shaw, a Harvard Medical School obstetrician, said, "An American mom today is 50% more likely to die in childbirth than her own mother was. Also, our babies have the highest infant mortality rate and lowest life expectancy at birth of 13 high-income countries. We spend the most by far on healthcare, but measures of our healthcare don't fare well in comparison. It's time to admit our system is not so great. We can do better." And that was written by Karen Clousing of Charleston. And we'll take a short break now and then return with the second half hour of the Friday, June 14th, 2019 edition of the News Gazette. I'm Sandra Ferguson. Please stay tuned.